Welcome, chums, to the Leslie Riddick podcast. This is one with a difference because we're actually on holiday this week. So we're playing an interview that we did with Professor Mark Blyth, something that we recorded as an extra, which the buddies and pals who subscribe heard about a month ago. Mark is the, well, some people know him as the sweary professor. You might have heard him on other podcasts. He's brilliant, controversial, provocative, unable to put in a box, from Dundee originally, now a prof over in the States. And he's got a lot of views about everything from the future of independence and how economics would work to the way that the whole economic system does operate at the moment. Ostensibly, we started interviewing him about his latest book, Angrinomics. We actually got totally sidetracked. That's the beauty of somebody who is a Renaissance man. So here is that podcast, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, hi, folks, and welcome to this special extra podcast for all you people who subscribe. And it's with Professor Mark Blyth, Eastman Professor of Political Economy at Brown University, also William R. Rhodes 57 Professor of International Economics and Director of the Rhodes Centre for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. No half bad, Mark, for a boy from the hill town who went to the
college. I tried to get as many titles as possible in case somebody stole one of them.
See, serious point though there, Mark. How important was your background growing up in Dundee, and particularly in that area of Dundee, to your beliefs, your thoughts, and the way you've taken forward your career in economics and political theory?
So if you have a look at the book I did about 8 years ago called Austerity, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which was all about why what Europe was about to do was a really bad idea, and we've done it before, it's always a bad idea, don't do it. They went ahead and did it, it was bad, right? And if you look at the preface of that, it actually talks about exactly what you're asking me, Pat, which is the following. When you do austerity, the policy of tightening your belt, in other words, cutting down on the public side of expenditure, in the belief that somehow doing this will stabilize debts and therefore make investors very happy and then you will recover faster. It doesn't work, but that's the idea. That when you're tightening your belt, we're not all wearing the same trousers. And there's a huge sort of asymmetry in the way that this hits. And we saw this in the austerity years under Osborne. And you look at towns like Preston in the north of England that had 30% of their effective expenditure cut. Meanwhile, in London, pennies were taken from the budget because they already had the growth, right? And you saw this right across the country. Scotland was a little bit insulated from that, but that was really what happened. And it's ultimately people who depend upon the public purse that pay the brunt of this. Now, I grew up, basically, as I say in America, as a welfare kid. And what does that mean? It means that I was raised by my grandmother at the top of the hill on Hospital Street by the old Infectious Diseases Hospital, which accounts for my robust immune system, I have to say. And, you know, what did we have in terms of income? We had her state retirement pension. My father had dropped by on a Friday and handed a fiver or a tenner and some meat from the slaughterhouse where he worked. And that was it. And as I say in the book, you know, when people talk about I went to school with holes in my shoes, I really did sometimes. But you know what? So did a lot of kids. And we still went to schools that worked. And those schools actually worked as ladders of mobility for those that had talent. And I think of the people that I went to school with, right? I mean, one that you'll definitely know, Chris van der Kyle, went on to become an incredibly successful Scottish entrepreneur. I went to school with him. Kit Clark, and the musician. Right, we used to play in a band together when I was at school. I mean, there was never any shortage of talent, right? There was plenty of shortage of cash. But back in the day, those institutions worked. Now, here's the problem with the class politics of austerity, if you like. It basically shuts down those schools. It shuts down those ladders of opportunity. It concentrates wealth amongst those who already have the wealth. And that's why it's important to me that I work in the things that I do and I say the things that I do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just like, because Leslie and I have often talked about this, and I talk about being at Forbank, and I was seeing kids coming in with holes in their shoes. I want one of the laddies to turn up because he's football mates. That's all he had. That's all he had to wear. And that was just like the absolute background to where I came from. And my beliefs were absolutely rooted in that personal experience. And you're absolutely right, again, because in looking at the fact of where people came from and where they went to, people that went to my school, went to the Forebank, went to Lawside, went to St Saviour's, St John's, and went on and achieved, because of the construction of that post-war consensus and welfare state. I'm going to ask a fairly obvious question here. If austerity is so economically illiterate, was it at an attack on the working class and blaming the crash that took place because of casino banking on too many libraries in Wolverhampton, as Alexei Sale said?
Right. And Alexei's right. I mean, why do you need that kind of politics of distraction? Well, for the Tories in particular, I mean, you know, you think about Osborne and Cameron, they were never comfortable with Hug a Hoodie, if you remember that nonsense, right? They just want to shut down the state because the state is ultimately funded by taxes, and those taxes are paid predominantly by people who have the money, which is their constituency. So when you have a financial crisis, their assets are at risk. You bail out the financial institutions, thereby bailing out their assets. You create a bunch of debts that need to be paid off at some point, and you turn that into a national scandal, and you use that as an excuse to cut down on state spending. And the asymmetry of that is it's the bottom 60% to pay the insurance, if you will, for the assets of the top 20%. So, you know, one of the ways that I describe this is a thing in finance called a put option, which gives you the right to buy something at a predetermined price and point in time, or you can let the option expire. You don't need to pick it up. So think about insurance as kind of optionality. And what austerity is, it's a class-specific put option whereby the working and middle classes pay for asset insurance for the rich. And that's essentially what the whole game is.
I mean, how is it that just, you know, because the book does seem to make it so clear, and you've cited various so many examples of this. But I mean, how is it that we all think that we're kind of, literate people, but fall for this idea that what is essentially a banking crisis is turned into a sovereign crisis that we all have to kind of patriotically tighten our belts to kind of cope with? How is it that we're falling, as it were, the population's falling for it, and voting for the very parties that actually administered this sting to us, at least south of the border, in ever-increasing numbers?
No, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, that's a mystery. But on the other hand, it's kind of not a mystery. So if you think about who were the architects of that implosion, it wasn't the Tories, it was New Labour. It was Peter Mandelson saying, I'm fantastically relaxed about people getting rich so long as they pay their taxes. Caveat, they didn't actually pay their taxes either. That's the whole tax haven stuff and all the rest of it. But let's put that to one side. So it was New Labour that was very much finished, if you will, the Thatcherite project. So, you know, as happened everywhere, let's put this in comparative perspective. If you were in charge when that went off in 2008, you got thrown out and the normal opposition came in. Then the normal opposition, after 4 years of this not working, basically get thrown out or get reduced majorities. And then you begin to see the beginnings of populism, whether it's Brexit, whether it's sort of the Italian far right, whether it's the Greek left, right? You see all these forces coming up in about 2012 to 2015. Some of them run their course. Some of them, like Podemos in Spain, become part of the establishment, although a critical part of the establishment. And if you look across the whole of Western Europe, you'll see party systems have been completely transformed. You think about France. The French left now get 8%. Now, this is a crisis that involves inequality. This is a crisis that involves poverty. This is a crisis that involves the rich getting away with it. Why is it the left aren't capitalizing upon that? Because they don't actually talk directly to it. They don't actually challenge it. If you think about what Miliband did, Miliband didn't come out and go, can you guys stop talking pish about Labour spent too much? That's just not true. Right? Instead of which, oh yes, no, we need to know the fiscal constraints. We need a fiscal rule, right? And people aren't stupid. They're just like, so in other words, you're just a Tweedledum to their Tweedledee, right? You're not actually doing anything different. So then you lose faith in that. And then when it seems to be the case, as increasingly is the case in the United Kingdom, and of course this is amplified by culture wars, etc. But when it does it is perceived to be the case that your putative left-wing party really is the party of upper middle class intellectuals, public service workers, university professors, and you care more about minorities than you do about your own working class, then they're not going to vote for you. And if you just think about it that way, it's pretty straightforward. They have no faith in those people. And that's the key thing.
Well, I mean, that explains why the Corbyn may have been extremely popular within the Labour Party and on the left in general, but was a failure in terms of the electorate, because he was seen to be, and was the narrative was that was promulgated, was the fact that he was an Islington lefty, more interested in minorities, not interested in the working class. And so the class message that he was putting across in terms of what was very much mainstream social democracy, wasn't left-wing at all, really, was ignored. And in fact, they went for the populism as expressed through Brexit with Johnson.
No, absolutely. That's exactly it. And if you think about, you know, most people don't have a lot of time to think about, you know, the global economy or any, or the EU or any of this nonsense. And there's the famous stat that if you did a Google search the day after Brexit, the most popular search was what was the European Union, right? So it's very easy to do that kind of, oh, what a bunch of morons or whatever, right? But you think about the emotive charge of the language of take back control. For a bunch of people who have seen their wages collapse, have seen their public services shrink, have seen their opportunities shrink. And then there's this notion that, like, somehow it's the fault of these other forces that are outside of our country. We need to take back control. What exactly was the Remain camp's alternative? Things will get really shitty if you do this, right? So it's basically the 2014 referendum all over again. So one version's Project Fear, and the other one is like some kind of agency will come back to you. You will have control. This will be more about you and your economy. That's a far more attractive case than, well, we might lose the Erasmus scheme. Oh, spoiler alert, most people don't go to university and don't give a shit about the Erasmus scheme.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's the, again, we will get, well, we've got to get on it. Leslie always tells me to stop doing this. We will go on this later. No, we'll get on to it now. Because I actually totally agree with you on that. I was a reluctant Remainer. I voted to Remain just because I was terrified what was coming down the road when this bunch of spivs got their hands on the economy. But when I...
Pat, unfortunately, they've had their hands on the economy for quite some time. This is just more of the same.
Aye. But again, I voted no to joining the European Union. I mean, back in the day when, and during the first referendum, because it was a rich man's club. And I think the points that you made actually in the newer book, Angrynomics, which actually goes to the core of it. You have absolutely no time for the structure and organisation of the European Union as currently constituted. In fact, perhaps not at all. These are not just flaws. This is a structural problem within the European Union in terms of, and as you cited the example of the appalling way that Greece, Portugal, Spain and Italy were treated by the European technocrats.
Yeah, I mean, that's fact. I wrote it. I'll stand by it. That's it. I mean, they built a kind of halfway house whereby you have what the economists call monetary dominance, this big, strong central bank that has one purpose, to guard against inflation. The only problem is there hasn't been any inflation of any meaningful size for 40 years. And when it comes to dealing with a giant banking crisis, the problem with giving away your printing press is the fact that then you can't bail your own banks. So then you're on the largesse of this thing called the ECB, who thinks its job isn't to do that. Its job is to fight an inflation that practically doesn't exist. So, you know, it was a great construction for fair weather days. It was a wonderful thing whereby, if so long as there was no problems and no shocks, everyone could pretend it was working. But once the thing was slammed with a big economic shock, then the way it worked out was essentially the creditors in the north wanted their money back from the debtors in the south. And the debtors in the south said, but you were the guys that lent us all this stuff anyway on the jolly that would never need to pay it back because interest rates were so low. Whoops.
Where does that leave us then in terms of the question I was going to ask? Because the offer that's being made by the SNP, which for all purposes is the dominant force within the drive towards Scottish independence. Mm-hmm. The Growth Commission has specifically said two things. One, that there will be a currency union with the United Kingdom, thus handing power over to the Bank of England, Monetary Policy Committee. And secondly, we're going to join the European Union. Now, what's your perspective on those two? I think I can guess what's coming.
Well, we're going to have to do two episodes, really, to cover this sort of stuff, because we're not going to sort of ram it into the last 20 minutes. We need to unpack all this, right? So let's start with the first one. I'm unfortunately somebody who spends a lot of time thinking about this, way too much. In fact, I spent about 3 months this year going through lots and lots of government reports from Scotland and figures from the ONS and everything else. And basically, I think everyone's bullshitting, frankly. And we can go into why that is. But I'll give you one example of this. The way that that's framed is just nuts. 60% of your exports go to England, right? That's it. That's huge. And you're, as a small open economy, right, you're export dependent. Now, what does that mean? It means that de facto, if you had your own currency, you're going to have a lot of volatility, movement up and down. Why? Because you're a small, thinly traded currency that's going to be subject to shocks. You're going to need big reserves in your central bank if you have your own currency to manage those shocks. Why do you need to manage those shocks? Because 60% of your exports go to one place. So how do small open economies deal with that? Whether it's the Finns, whether it's the Danes, whether it's the Swedes, what do? They peg to the euro. Why? Because 60% of their stuff goes there. Once you peg, you don't have autonomy, right? You don't. You're basically managing it so that de facto you have the same exchange rate as them, which is kind of the same as having the pound. So basically, you know, this whole notion that Scotland has its own currency and therefore has monetary autonomy ignores the fact that it's a small open economy and the rules for small open economies are just different. You're not the US, right? This story, it just isn't going to work. So that's the first point on that one. The second one, in joining the EU, well, if you do, you better hope to reform the growth, the rules around fiscal debts and deficits. Because if they don't, then you're going to have a fiscal consolidation that's going to make Greece look like a sangria party. Because you're going to be joining, and admittedly, everybody, because of COVID, is going to have bigger debts and deficits, so the pressure's off and they are going to reform the rules in some way. But you're meant to basically really constrict your economy down to the levels that have caused chronically low growth and high unemployment across the European Union, particularly in the south. You're going to strangle your economy so that you can join this bigger bloc where you have no monetary policy autonomy at all or fiscal policy because you're giving up your currency. Right. So frankly, this is why I think everyone's bullshitting, right? Because if you start off with the sort of the orthodox analysis that you've got in the Growth Commission report, it reads like something out of 2012, whereby it's all about central banks and independence and credibility and inflation and all this sort of stuff. And we just don't live in that world anymore. And if you go to the other side of it and all you need is your own currency and you'll be totally fine, it completely ignores the fact that the caveat on all these ideas, modern monetary theory, is that you have a country that can reasonably well provision itself, right? So just think about Scotland. Is it ever going to make its own cars? No. Drugs? No, right? It imports everything. So that means that your exchange rate politics become incredibly important. And if they're going up and down and up and down all the time, that's a big problem. So what are you going to end up doing? You're going to end up pegging either to the pound or to the euro. Right. So we need to start with the world as it actually is, as opposed to the fantasy objects that people talk about in the way that they want to see this because it's politically convenient. So there, I didn't say what you expected.
I'm thinking about all the different, you know, you mentioned Denmark, kind of all the small Nordic countries are equally, I mean, they're the bumblebee economies. Nobody to an extent knows how they work, but they work. And they seem to be, well, they're AAA rated, practically all of them except Iceland, but, you know, give it time. Well, maybe not. You know, so it feels like there's sort of a model out there. Now, of course, they've spent hundreds of years getting where they are. They became independent and made their big jumps and changes at times that are not so fraught with danger, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it looks like there's kind of at some point in the kind of medium future, there's a kind of, you know, there's a sort of parallel of some sort there. Is that just completely unattainable? I mean, some of them, like I'm thinking about Estonia, which I did a wee film about, had 100% of its trade with the Soviet Union and stopped mm-hmm. that overnight. I don't think anybody would want the experience the Estonians had in 1991 when the whole thing went cold turkey right enough. But they shifted themselves completely around and they did go through various iterations of currency, you know, before embracing the euro. So Is that such a scary path that you're describing? Is that a sort of, you just can't become independent because the options are just too
No, I don't. Scotland, I'll be quite clear on it. Scotland can be independent, but let's do the Brexit analogy rather than a Baltic analogy, because I think the Baltic one, for every time, Estonia and eGov and democracy is great, and next door you got Latvia, which is basically a giant money laundering factory that's lost 30% of its population because everyone lives abroad. So, you know, you can pick a good one, you can pick a bad one, right? Now, you know, let's talk about the Brexit thing. So the argument on Brexit, which is true, is, well, that was stupid because you're basically saying that you want to have more free trade, so you're leaving the largest free trade bloc in the world so you can have more free trade, right? That makes no sense. So clearly, trade's going down. Discount all the COVID effects, you can see that. So Britain as a whole has to basically make up that trade somewhere, which you can do, but it will take time and it's not easy to do it, but you can do it, right? Now, what about Scotland? Scotland has been joined at the hip to the English economy. In fact, it grew up with it. If 30 years of unpicking the EU is going to be difficult, think about 300 years of deep economic integration. This makes Brexit look like sort of, you know, a casual fling on the weekend, right? This is really, really deep. Now, can you undo that? Yes, but the more you undo that, the more you're basically doing a Brexit to yourself, because at the end of the day, 60% of your exports go to England. So meaningful divergence means that you're not going to trade with them anymore, which means you need to find trade elsewhere. Can you do that? Absolutely. Is it going to take a wee bit of time? Yes. I'm sure you know David McWilliams. McWilliams has a great line on this. He talks about when Ireland became independent in 73, it then became, as he called it, the Taliban years. It was essentially a Catholic theocracy run by the priesthood right through till 1973, where the greatest export of the economy were labourers moving in and out of London, right? The place was terrible. It took them 50 years to figure out how they were going to do it. Now, does Scotland need to go through that? No, because it doesn't have a theocracy in the wings, thankfully, and it's in a much better place. But if you want to become Denmark, that's going to take a generation. It's a generational project, right? And to get there will require costs. There's no doubt about that. And anyone who said, no, it won't be costless, right? You're just lying, right? It's just nonsense. So can you get there? Yes. Is Scotland attached to a beast called the rump English economy that is primarily London and everybody else lives off of transfers? Yes. Is that healthy? No. If you can get away from that, should you? Yeah, if you've got a viable plan. I'm just waiting to see the viable plan. That's the important thing. How are you going to do this? I'll tell you something. You know how difficult it is to find some stuff out? I tried to find out exactly what the Scottish economy is composed of. So on aggregate level, I can find this. I can find it in terms of different sectors, all the rest of it. But just trying to find out things like, you know, what's the average size of a Scottish business? Those 60% of exports that go to England, what are we doing? They're services. I can't imagine what much of that is. I mean, I don't imagine Edinburgh solicitors in Scotland are writing contracts on English mortgages, right? So it'd be good to know what that is. In fact, knowing that would be the prerequisite of having a plan. But you can go through all the stuff that people have generated and you just don't have that level of data. So I think everyone's kind of just talking bollocks.
So, yeah, no.
Do you think that's, you know, because I mean, this point has been made. There's a think tank, Common Wheel, here that's made very sort of similar points and tears its hair out on a regular basis about the lack of statistics and information that's in the kind of public domain. I think there's some wishful thinking and hope perhaps that kind of within the bowels of government there's, you know, a serious plan going on. Do you think there's any potential for that to be being hatched and just not in the public domain, or do you think this is, you know, just not happening?
I don't know if it's not happening because I'm not privy to the conversations, but I mean, it would seem to me that, you know, there's a kind of the Quebec analogy up here that I'm thinking is you get two bites at the cherry, you don't get a third, right? Yeah. So if you're going to go for this now, you need to have a convincing plan that's going to get you to about 60%, because you can't do a Brexit with independence with this level of integration. Right, you can't do 52-40 on this one. If you really want this to work without Scotland becoming a very polarized place, you've got to get at least to 55, if not up to 60. I'm not sure the numbers are there yet. And why are the numbers not there yet? Because people are saying, well, what's the plan? Like, really, what's the plan? What are we doing on the first? And it's very simple stuff, right? I mean, let's take the currency question, right? I would do it something like this. On the first day, I'd say, yeah, you know what? Everybody's got the pound. We use the pound. Ultimately, use money because it's useful, right? It's the thing you use. It's a tool, right? So we could ask people to just overnight swap this out for Scottish pounds or whatever we're going to call them. But we're going to take 3 years. And we will basically use the pound for 3 years. But in year one, we're going to issue some debt from the new Scottish Debt Office. We're going to see what the interest rate on that is. And then we're going to basically work with various bodies very transparently to bring in a currency. And we're going to do it at this date, right? And then you just monitor what happens, whether that's credible, whether people have faith in it, whether they start opening their bank accounts in Carlisle, right? And if they don't, you can move forward step by step. That requires like clarity. That requires having that singular purpose and making people, bringing people along with you so they know what's going on. And it just seems to me that's simply not what's happening. It seems to be very polarized. where you've got people who on the left are basically have read MMT, which I think applies to countries like America and China and doesn't apply to places like either the European Union or small open economies particularly well. And then you've got the right-wing version of it, which is like something out of the European Commission circa 2011. And you're like, really? I mean, this is the best we can come up with? We're in a world whereby inflation's at historic lows and that's probably not going to change. Interest rates are been falling for 700 years. Everybody and their granny now has debt to GDP of 100% coming out of COVID. So if Scotland were to be independent at this point, it's a pretty good time to do it. How difficult can it be? Let me give you the optimistic side of this one. So Danny Blanchflower said this to me, and I think it's a great way of thinking about it. It's two big cities that are 20 miles apart that are already quite well networked. And that's 65% of the economy right there. Throw in Aberdeen.
4 miles apart, just to not get everybody thrown. Is that Glasgow, Edinburgh you're talking about?
Yeah.
Right, aye, okay.
Right, yeah. And then you've got Dundee and Aberdeen, right? Aberdeen will be wound down because of carbon eventually, right? But that's your oil town. You've got Dundee. You've got a few other small towns. You've got 4 million people. More people live in Brooklyn, New York than live in Scotland. Right? How hard can it be to turn this into an independent entity? If you're smart about it, and if you bring the people with you, and you've got a plan that's convincing that says, yeah, this will hurt for like 5 or 10 years, but you know what? Your kids will have a much better future. Then I think people are willing to go with that, because there's loads of reasons why.
So what is it? I mean, what is it you think that just stops that level of sort of honesty being part of the independence debate? I mean, it's clearly there's the personality of the First Minister and the drive of that, but actually, there's a strange thing. I mean, having personally speaking been at university in England, you know, grew up in Northern Ireland, just went to Cardiff for a university course to get the full kind of, you know, all the kind of gogs in.
Check them all.
And obviously, aye, and brought up in Scotland. There's a tremendous sort of ability to scare the shit out of Scots about this kind of thing, which, I mean, if you look then at the English population that voted for Brexit in a kind of, come on if you think you're hard enough kind of way, there doesn't seem to be the same sort of fear of the unknown south of the border, whereas there seems to be a tremendous fear of the unknown in Scotland, again, in comparison to a lot of the Nordic countries that surround us.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. I mean, I think part of it is, you know, it's not just the Celtic Rangers sectarianism. There's a great deal of division politically as well. And the SNP managed to hold this together by essentially being, well, at least pretending to be a business-friendly left-wing party, right? Whatever that actually is. But there is a sort of a polarization. You know, the Scottish left are deeply, deeply distrustful of the private sector. And it's not clear to me how you can be independent and make your way in a global economy if you basically think that the government's going to replace the private sector. That tends not to work too well. You need to have the two of them. And Scandinavia is absolutely the proof of that, right? I mean, you know, they are pretty intense private sector driven economies, but they have very good social safety nets, right? And that's where you want to end up. Similarly, there's a sort of a crisis of confidence, I think, on the right in terms of, you know, perhaps, as you're saying, this lack of confidence vis-a-vis, you know, English nationalism versus Scottish nationalism. I mean, I'm well off my reservation at this point, so I don't want to go too far. But and again, it seems that sort of we're just not talking to each other, right? We're talking past each other. So, you know, you see the sort of the Greens and the left shouting more and more at the SNP as if they're the problem. And then you see the SNP basically ignoring their own left, even though they're the people that are going to turn out the vote. And it's like, this is not going well, right? You need to have a plan you can actually agree upon. And it doesn't have to be all one way or the other, but it needs to be clear and convincing to most people.
Does any of this fit into the template that you have, you know, the kind of tribal outrage? I mean, I know we're now trying to get huge ideas sandwiched into an extraordinarily short period of time. But, you know, your latest...
Can we just come back and do a... We'll do a second one, right? Let's continue the conversation.
Okay, that's fine. Right.
We'll do a second one.
Pat, go for it.
What we actually got, the point I think it was going to make, was we actually got a First Minister who is notorious for not being collegiate. And I think from what you're saying, I mean, I spoke to people during the independence campaign with whom you would think I had very little in common, who are business owners and everything like that. I'm definitely of the left. We find we had a community of interest in terms of a progressive society where people were fairly rewarded for a fair day's work, were treated appropriately, had proper housing, etc. Mm-hmm. And there are other aspects to it as well. For example, and I'm very heavily influenced by what's been going on with the Preston model in terms of setting up cooperatives, mm-hmm. and alternative methods of actually organising private enterprise, if you like, which yeah. gives people back control within their own employment area. And I think yeah. at your work having control and giving that sense of control back within that kind of framework, you can bring what appear to be two sets of competing ideas together from theoretical left and right together.
I applaud anybody who tries to do that, because I think that's exactly the way to do it. I don't know. You're the guys who are living there. Tell me, do you think that's what's going on?
No.
The question is why?
Because there's still this perception that even though there's countries like Finland that have produced the largest forester cooperatives on the planet, that have been incredibly successful in having loads of small farmer foresters work together to supply all the pulp and paper pulp for the newspaper industry in Europe, still the idea of cooperatives looks like open-toed sandals here. You know, there's still mm-hmm. this really kind of, you know, that's a bit of a dodgy idea. I mean, cooperatives, if you've been to Finland, you can't go anywhere without hitting a cooperative. They run the ferries, they run the hotels, but we don't get out much, you know, so we're stuck in this British mode of thinking, the us yeah. versus them. And if it's going to be us versus them, and if that's the only polarities that exist, okay, we're going to be us, not them. But trying to jump beyond it, you know, seeing's believing. And we right. just haven't seen enough examples of cooperatives working, apart from obviously the kind of trade union base that is, you know, that's still sitting at the heart of a lot of stuff in Scotland that provides some of the structure for thinking that allows people to take a bit of a leap of faith and think, well, maybe we can organize ourselves. I mean, I was part of a community buyout in the Island of Egg that did just that. And the kind of amount of negative self-talk people had to overcome to think they could run something themselves was fucking titanic. But right. there's just not enough examples around for people to think that they can manage also, stuff themselves.
But, you know, be fair to people for a minute on this one, because, you know, the past 40 years has been an exercise in stripping public assets to the mm-hmm. bone and shoveling them off to whoever has the cash to pay for them and then buying them back once those people make an arse of it. I mean, that's essentially sort of what we've been doing. Now, you know, when that's the case, the notion of public ownership, particularly with the media that will just turn around and say, oh, well, that's the 1970s and we're all going to die, right? You know, all this sort of stuff. You understand why people, they do this, because they have no experience of these things. It's not just like they don't really see the examples, right? It is literally incomprehensible because they don't exist where they are, right? So perhaps part of getting there is, you know, one of the things that's reasonably successful is when one tries to have constitutional conventions. And those things decide things like proportional representation and rules and who gets to vote and the structure of this, that, and the next thing. What Scotland needs is a kind of economic constitutional convention, right? Where basically people with good faith, with no axe to grind, can just get together and basically say, all right, what is this thing, right? Get the Scottish government, you know, thinking people and starts producing people on board with this. Make them work for this so that you could have, let's say, 100 Scots taken from all the different places to sit down for 6 months and just say, all right, so what does the Scottish economy look like, right? Explain to me, right? Who are the firms? Who are our 10 biggest firms? What do we export? Where do we export to, right? And then just task those people with thinking through what the future of this thing could look like. And that would be a good way of both getting exposure for those ideas, but also, and making them more normal, not so scary, right? But then also basically making people face, you know, the hard constraints. You know, think about sort of not just the currency stuff I was talking about with being a small open economy. Think about the fact that, you know, you've got digital giants. There are no European digital giants. Yeah, Amazon's all the rest of it, right? They're all American. Facebook, et cetera, et cetera. FinTech is revolutionizing finance. So, you know, Edinburgh's got a good financial sector, but FinTech basically could blow up the margins and loads of those businesses over time. There's looming crisis because of climate change with insurance, right? Which is one of the things that Scotland also does in finance. So, you know, we don't just have to think about things that we don't do that we could do that we could draw from Finland. What have we got here now that's actually of value? Right? Well, how do we make money? Right? Really, how does this country make money? Because if you can't answer that, you can't do much. Right? And that's the type of level of conversation where it's not about left or right principles. At the end of the day, you want to be independent. To quote David McWilliams, it's the right to screw up on your own. Yeah. Right? It's the right to screw up on your own. And if you're going to screw up, you're going to hurt people. So you have a responsibility to try and not screw up, which means basically not talking about the stuff that you're comfortable with, but talking to people who will turn around and say things like, well, how are we going to pay for that, frankly? And if the answer is you can just print it, no. It doesn't work like that for small open economies. But we can get into that in another episode.
Yeah, I know you've got to go. I mean, we have actually got a citizens' assembly that was set up by the Scottish Government that's been working through some thoughts about the future. The trouble is, as soon as it looks like that's being set a question about how you'd run an independent Scotland, you suddenly get a complete lack of buy-in from, you know, half the possible participants, because, you know, it's part of an independence project they don't approve of. So it's kind of a difficult thing to set up. But these are also
you could do it cross-party, whatever, right? But I understand those constraints. But I mean, let's talk about the one whereby the Halifax Group or whatever, it used to be the Royal Bank, right? So the head of that came out and said, well, if you go independent, we're off to London, right? Well, it's not because they hate the idea of independence. The person involved might quite possibly like it. But she has a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders of that institution that says that that bank needs insurance and regulation in such a way that it can continue to do business in the way that it does. If it sits in an independent Scotland that doesn't really have a financial regulator of any height and doesn't have a central bank that basically has got its back when it gets into trouble, it can't stay there. It literally can't. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it's sort of, we need to change our minds on how we think about these things. It's not, they are being disloyal. No, they have a responsibility to their institution. And if we do this, then they will go. That's it. It's that simple, right? And facing those realities, I think, is like the most important thing that can happen over the next few years.
Right. You've got to go. So we're going to let you go. And the Economic Constitutional Convention, I'm thinking about that. My brain's going overtime already. I'm sure Pat's the same.
So
we're going to take you up on that offer, Mark, absolutely. And thank you very much for it. That we'll come back.
Yeah, let's do it soon so we can continue the energies.
So that was Professor Mark Blythe, the irrepressible professor. If you'd like to hear the second of our podcasts with him, where we finally got to discuss his book, Angronomics, then you can become a subscriber. Pals or buddies are able to subscribe at leslieriddick.com/podcast.